everyone, and welcome to Risky Business number 183. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by another new sponsor for 2011, NetWitness. They are the makers of some pretty damn interesting software too, so you can go check them out at netwitness.com. We'll be joined by NetWitness CSO Eddie Schwartz a bit later on for this week's sponsor interview. But in this week's feature interview, we're taking a look at Ligat Security and its chief executive, Gregory D. Evans. He describes himself as, quote, the world's number one hacker, and he's been a frequent expert guest on CNN and Fox News in the United States. But he's had a bad month, Mr. Evans. His mail spool got popped, which I guess makes him the world's number two hacker. And CBS in Atlanta, Georgia, have run a fiercely critical expose on Evans, detailing his checkered past and questioning his claims of expertise. So we'll be joined by Jericho of attrition.org. He's been tracking Evans and Ligat's activities over the years, and he'll fill us in with a bit of history. Also in this week's show, as I mentioned, we'll be chatting with NetWitness CSO Eddie Schwartz, and Eddie will be joining us to discuss some of the new approaches in the fight against malware, particularly, you know, O-Day malware or malware that has not been previously identified. You know, do you really need a signature for a bit of malware if you can see that one of your endpoints is trying to grab a zip file from a box in China over port 443 and it's not using SSL? Probably not, right? So that's kind of what we're talking about, and that's coming up later. But before we get into all of that, it's time for a check of the week's news headlines with Adam Boileau. And Adam, the fallout from the HP Gary federal hack just keeps rolling, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. It certainly is the hack that keeps on hacking. The couple of sites that have been put up with like live access to their email and stuff, although they seem to be going up and down pretty often. But yeah, there's lots of interesting things sort of leaking out of the various mails from their mail spool, and some interesting revelations about their so-called Magenta rootkit proposal.
Well, it wasn't just that. I mean, we started off talking about this last week, and it was still kind of a developing story. And when we were discussing it, there was this emerging story that HP Gary Federal had proposed, you know, hacking WikiLeaks' submission process to gain intelligence on leakers and out them to sort of destroy the site's credibility, which is pretty, you know, James Bond villain sort of stuff. But since then, we've learned that they were putting together a proposal for the American Chamber of Commerce to do things like smear the relatives of union officials and union leaders. And these guys, they had a lot of dirty laundry that's wound up on the net. You cannot deny it.
They did indeed, and it appeared like it was the same legal firm that they were involved with that they were pitching to Bank of America through with the American Chamber of Commerce. So it's still quite
what a surprise. Someone's being a scumbag and there's a law firm involved.
Yeah, I know. I am shocked. but no, it seemed to be the same sort of pitch, like the same style of thing. But yeah, in this case, you know, including people's families and, you know, kids and all that sort of thing. So yeah, certainly pretty sleazy. And the thing I find quite funny about this is that, given that they were doing it with Bank of America, specifically to combat WikiLeaks, this leak that's come out of the HP Gary thing is exactly the sort of thing that WikiLeaks is meant to be leaking. Like, this is exactly why, when WikiLeaks is doing its thing right, this is what it's meant to be, kind of shedding light on. And the irony is that that their dirty laundry about trying to combat WikiLeaks is what we're now seeing leaked.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's been quite interesting, actually, because whoever, you know, obtained these mail spools, or someone anyway, got the mail spools, threw them up on anonleaks.ru, you know, put a search front end on it. So, of course, everyone's doing vanity searches on that database to make sure they're not named. Unfortunately, risky.biz doesn't feature, or I suppose that should be fortunate that we're not on the radar of such people, but it was...
Although apparently my Firewire stuff was in the mail spool somewhere, someone was telling me. I haven't actually managed to vanity Google myself in the mail spool, but yeah, apparently it was actually in there.
Well, I'm sure Aaron Barr was planning to use it to do something evil to anti seal fur campaigners or something like that, you know. He was planning on using it to disrupt the activities of a children's charity or something like that. But, you know, in addition to all of that stuff, we found out it's provided us a real insight into the operation of a company that deals largely with organizations that do a lot of classified stuff, you know, whether that's law enforcement or intelligence. And of course, you know, it seems that governments are active buyers of stuff like rootkit technology, which we've always sort of suspected, but it's really quite something to see it there in black and white, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I think it's quite enlightening to have, you know, such empirical evidence for, you know, for the people who are, you know, sort of fence sitting about whether or not this actually happens, whether or not, you know, government, law enforcement or whatever are out there buying this stuff in the marketplace and, you know, and paying people to do that sort of research. So it's good to have some genuine, you know, the primary source evidence to point to say, yes, this does happen. Yes, it happens in the US. Yes, you Americans are, you know, your tax dollars are specifically paying for this kind of stuff.
Well, and one of the Trojans that was proposed, I think it's called the Magenta Trojan, and some of the emails that have leaked have shown that, hey, you know, it looks like pretty effective technology, looks like it would be extremely difficult to detect, extremely difficult to remove. So it sounds like, you know, all signs point to, you know, the level of sophistication in that sort of subversion technology in government classified circles. All evidence is starting to point to the idea that, you know, hey, maybe these guys do actually have a pretty significant and well-developed capability in that area, which, you know, is kind of, to a degree, it's a little bit surprising that they're actually that on top of their game.
Yeah, well, on the other hand, right, Greg Hoglund has been running rootkit.com for a long damn time. You think if anyone knew, you know, what to put in a modern rootkit in the year 2011, then it would be him. So, yeah, I mean, I guess they are engaging people who do know what they're doing.
Well, I guess that's what I'm saying is the surprising part.
The competence, you mean? Yeah.
Well, the fact that they actually, you know, they didn't run off and try to buy it from EDS, you know?
Well, Sony.
Sony got a bit of expertise in the old Trojan area as well.
They do indeed.
But, you know, look, I just think this whole episode has been quite fascinating. I got to say, my sympathy for HB Gary Federal, you know, dried up very damn quickly after viewing some of those emails. They really seem like they're involved in some pretty unsavory stuff. And it's been a fascinating 10 days and a fascinating little insight into that world, hasn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is an insight into that sort of hive of villainy that seems to follow around, you know, that kind of military industrialization of hacking that, you know, we're both fond of talking about.
Yes, we are. Also, we should note that the Russian website, the hbgary.anonleaks.ru site, that's now offline. The mail torrents, of course, are out there, but even the mirrors are gone.
Yeah, by the time I went to look, certainly all the mirrors had died along with the main site. But the Pirate Bay tracker appeared to have, you know, 40-50 cedars still on it. So I guess that stuff is still live if you want it.
Well, moving on to something a little bit more vanilla, and the New South Wales Ambulance Service here in Australia, the operators of that service had to revert to a paper process when their computer network was penetrated by a unnamed computer virus. I mean, this really shouldn't happen to this degree, should it?
No, really, really, it shouldn't. And I guess we're swapping from a story where we had, you know, we were shocked by government competence, and now we're shocked by government incompetence.
Oh, no, really? Adam, this is the New South Wales, this is a New South Wales state government operated service, okay? This is the most incompetent state government in the country. I shit you not, we're about 3 or 4 days away from heads on pikes in this state. It's getting that bad. And yeah, no one is surprised that this government is actually exhibiting this sort of incompetence. But still, you'd think in an emergency services sort of scenario, they'd at least, you know, roll AV, right?
You would think that. On the other hand, they probably ran, you know, Computer Associates eTrust or something, and we know how good a job that is.
What the fuck, man?
Does.
Why is it always CA with you? Why? Like, why not share the pain? Why not give a bit of shit to Trend? Why is it always CA?
I'll put $20 on the fact that if you phone them up and ask what AV they're running CA eTrust. The governments always do it. They always buy the nasty, nasty eTrust.
Why not share the pain? I mean, they're all, you know, Trend's pretty bad. Why not hang a bit of shit on Trend?
This is true. I've seen mail servers that were running Trend AV fail open and turn into open mail relays as punishment for having your license run out. So, yeah, I guess that's also pretty bad.
Lol. But anyway, yeah, I mean, we're all agreeing here that this isn't good enough.
Yeah, and shame on you, New South Wales antivirus guys, whoever the hell you are.
Well, you know, the story's pretty clear. They had to revert to manual processes. It's all up, all back up now. I'm sure people are getting their asses kicked all up and down the line. And look, I just hope that if I have a heart attack or a car accident or something, that they're not, you know, having to do everything on pen and paper, because that might actually cause some dramas. Now, this next story, Adam, is one I know that this is both close to your heart and mine. Lush Cosmetics was actually, you may have heard a news story a couple of months ago that their UK website got owned, a whole bunch of customer data leaked. It was a pretty big deal, lots of crying, wailing, gnashing of teeth, etc., etc. Well, it turns out their Australian and New Zealand websites actually used the same CMS or the same e-commerce system, and they've been popped as well. And all of their credit card, all of their customers' credit card details have gone. And oh no's.
Do you think there's a pattern there?
Yeah,
I think maybe. Let me think about it. Maybe there is just some relationship between these two events. What do you think?
Yeah, I think someone should have seen this one coming, to be honest.
just a little bit, yes. So they got popped and, a whole bunch of credit cards taken and, as you say, wailing and gnashing of teeth. But really, a little bit self-inflicted this time around, I think.
Yeah, it is. But, I mean, that doesn't help the customers. And, I mean, I've stayed at your house. I have been in your bathroom. I have seen Lush Cosmetics products there, you know, and commented on them because, you know, I had a girlfriend who used to bring that stuff home, right? So, you know, you and I are both familiar with these products.
Well, his beard doesn't take care of itself, you know.
I'm hoping you didn't actually buy this stuff online, though, Adam.
Hell no. Walk into the shop, man. Interact with actual people and e-commerce crap. Jesus.
But at least here in Australia and New Zealand, they are actually being a little bit more forthcoming about the breach than they were in England.
So, yeah, they've advised their customers to contact the bank of their concern and get their credit cards reissued, which I guess is a good thing. But really, yeah, next time, maybe you should spot that one coming.
Now, after a series of press reports in Australia that said that Vodafone had, you know, placed... It was very confused press reports. I'm not sure if we actually covered this. I think we may have, saying that the press reports at the time were a little bit confused. They were saying that Vodafone had made all of this customer information accessible over the web and there was wholesale abuse and credit card numbers flying around. Well, the Australian Privacy Commissioner has actually done a bit of an investigation and found that things weren't nearly as bad as were mentioned in press reports, and the press reports were largely incorrect. However, it did find that Vodafone here in Australia had not actually taken adequate steps to protect user data as considered appropriate with the national privacy principles. So, I mean, interesting little finding.
Yeah, indeed. And it turns out that what was actually going on when it was their credit checking and ID validation system, or the system that collected that data so that they could do ID checks, was using shared logins, I guess, per store, seems to be the report. And so there was no actual accountability in terms of individual people. It was just tied down to a store, which, you know, is not really authentication best practice. Having an individual audit trail is, an expectation you would have of an organization that size. I guess the fact that they've been called out in the media and then subsequently by the Privacy Commission means they've done something about that, and that's good.
Well, you know what happens to you here in Australia when there's an adverse finding against you from the Privacy Commissioner, don't you?
Pretty much call, is my understanding.
Yeah, absolutely nothing. Absolutely all. I guess they're,
bad Vodafone, no biscuit. That's
yeah,
pretty much
I
it, right?
Just, yeah. I don't think anyone really at Vodafone would be giving a shit, but the press coverage of all of this would have really hurt them. So I'm sure that there's some projects underway internally to address a lot of this stuff. And Adam, in this next little piece that comes to us via ZDNet Australia, written by Darren Pawley, it's an interesting little piece, actually, because it outlines a recommendation by the Australian Institute of Criminology that if we wish to reduce incidents of cybercrime, government tenders need to basically toughen up and take more security more seriously and have greater security requirements. And this will lead us to a culture of security. What do you make of all of this?
When I was reading the article that you sent me through in the news brief, I found myself mentally thumping the table and going here, because, having people put security metrics as contractual requirements, when they're doing RFPs, when they're, buying stuff from outsource providers, or when they're buying any sort of service. Yeah, I mean, that's something that we are constantly trying to drum into our customers. It is an important, part of the process. And I think as we move towards software as a service and cloud computing and, people outsourcing stuff higgledy-piggledy all over the internet, having clear security metrics and demanding clear security metrics as part of those contracts is a critical piece of doing it right. So I think this is a great a great thing that you know, people are actually out there talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just I think it's really cool having that sort of recommendation come from the Institute of Criminology, because you'd think they'd have a fairly decent high level understanding of any sort of crime ecosystem, if you want to use that sort of terminology.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, the fact or the suggestion that governments have a specific leadership role to, you know, kind of drag the providers of say, software as a service, you know, into delivering a more secure product because they have a different set of responsibilities than a regular commercial organization. I mean, if you're a, you know, a private company, right, you have a responsibility to make money and that's about it. Whereas a government, you have some social responsibility as well. And so, yeah, being able to push security requirements much harder is something that, yeah, I think governments really, really should lead in. And in the case of software as a service, right, where people who are providing software as a service don't have the same amount of eyes looking at code. Like if you have an off-the-shelf product, right, it gets looked at by hackers. If you have an open-source product, it gets looked at by people who are downloading the code. Whereas software as a service, all we see is the front end. We have no visibility of the back end. So,
well, that depends. That depends on the contractual relationship between you and that provider. I mean, I know of plenty of cases where, you know, a software as a service provider that wants to do business with, say, a bank. I mean, they're getting audited up the clacker, mate. Believe me, and their code is being viewed by many eyeballs.
Governments do have, you know, more leverage than your average smaller business. The bank, okay, is in a different situation than say someone like Lush, right? If they were outsourcing their retail operation, right? It's not big enough for them to be able to pay for or demand that kind of audit.
Whereas a
government department or a government that has that much purchasing power really can push that, even if they don't necessarily have the amount of money or the amount of resources that the bank might have to put behind actually doing an audit.
Well, and as they say, this is about creating a culture of security. Turning our attention for the moment to the United States, you know, fine example of government incompetence here. But the United States government accidentally, shut down 84,000 websites when they were trying to take down, what was it, like a kiddie porn site? And they accidentally took down some, you know, massive dynamic DNS provider or something. Or it wasn't even a DIN DNS provider. It was a standard DNS provider, right?
Yeah, so apparently they took over this domain because they had some information that there was kiddie porn being hosted and they accidentally hit, I think somebody else was hosted on the same subdomain that was running a DNS provider, and then they ended up redirecting 80-something thousand domain names to a website saying, hi, this website's been taken off because it probably had kiddie porn on it, you know, with US government logos, which, you know, if that was your website, just going about your business, it's going to make you a little upset, I'd have thought.
Yeah, I don't know that that's really good for business, you know. yeah. I don't know if you want...
Not so much.
Yeah, I don't know if you want, I am a child pornographer, you know, like written all over your website. Not really good. So effectively, these businesses were defaced by the United States government. Way to go.
Yeah.
Operation Save Our Children.
And of course, their recourse and, you know, the oversight on this is what exactly? Where's the warrant? It's all very confusing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I don't know about DHS and what is it? Immigration and Customs Enforcement in the US are getting involved in this as well. And it's like, everyone thinks they can pull domains. It's a little bit, I don't know. I don't really like it. And this is a great example of why I don't really like it.
Well, exactly. It's a great example of how to do it wrong and, you know, how to, collateral damage just really doesn't help you.
No.
You know, in trying to actually achieve something.
Now, before we end the news for the week, Adam, this is the funny story. This is what I remember once you referred to it as the story of the skateboarding cat that wound up in the tree, which I thought was an excellent way to combine, you know, the skateboarding cat story with the cat in the tree story. You never did explain to me, mate, how the cat wound up in the tree with its skateboard. But in the with this being the idea of this being the funny news story for the week, this is freaking hilarious, man. There's a bug, a pre-auth, like complete pwnage system level bug in, drumroll please, Adam,
the Cisco Security Agent Management Console.
For the win.
Yes, indeed. It's a remote pre-auth system bug in your Security Agent Management Console. Well, I'm sure glad that all those lovely marketing glossies from Cisco, which were so very reassuring about the positive effect that Cisco would have on my enterprise security policy, I am glad that they were so very glossy and convincing, because you know what? Just got owned.
Ain't this just the sweetest thing? And what's really funny too is that this is, I mean, Man, I could exploit this. This is a doozy.
Yeah, it does look like a pretty straightforward bug. Cisco, yeah, you definitely get our Risky Biz Fail of the Week award. Cisco sucks. Sucks to be you.
Yep, but the good news is there's a patch out there, so everybody's running Cisco's Security Agent Management Console. You might want to go and get it. But I think it's going to take a while for that to be dethroned. I think that could be the bucket of fail of the month, and I think it might stay bucket of fail for the year for at least a couple of months, because this is spectacular.
It is indeed a pretty spectacular fail, and you can rest assured, Cisco, that we will definitely check back in to make sure that it is still fail of the month, or indeed fail of the quarter.
We need a sound effect for that.
We do indeed.
Okay, Adam, that is actually all we have this week in the news. Thank you, mate, for joining us, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Thanks very much, Pat. Talk to you later.
Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. It's time for this week's feature interview now, and we're taking a closer look at Mr. Gregory D. Evans of Ligat Security. This guy has been discussed quite a bit in some circles in information security, but if you don't know the story, here's the short version. Gregory Evans is a convicted felon who now serves as the chief executive of a penny stock information security firm called Ligat Security. He's been interviewed as an authority on information security by CNN, Fox News, Bloomberg, and CBS, talking about everything from computer hacking to the recent DDoS attacks on Visa and MasterCard. He's also written a stack of books on computer security and an autobiographical account of his time as a super hacker extraordinaire. The only problem is, many respected information security industry figures say Gregory D. Evans is a charlatan. They say he knows next to nothing about computer security, that his books are largely plagiarized, and that he doesn't have the necessary skills to offer services in the security space, let alone front CNN with his views. So how the hell did he wind up becoming such a prominent commentator? Well, we'll find out shortly. Our next guest, Jericho of attrition.org, has been investigating Evans for some time, posting the results of his research on Attrition's errata page. It was the work of Jericho and others like him that ultimately brought the Ligat issue to the fore. It's taken some time, but questions around Evans' credibility have recently gained momentum. Things picked up in particular when Ligat was owned and Evans' mail spool leaked. And if that wasn't distressing enough for the poor bugger, CBS Atlanta decided to do a 4-minute primetime expose on Evans and his company.
Tough questions tonight for a man who claims to be one of the world's top computer security experts.
We found this self-proclaimed number one hacker may be nothing more than a hoax. When we started asking tough questions about what's really behind that professional image.
Get out of my face with that bullshit.
He's a convicted felon who served time for wire fraud.
The vast majority of the book was a direct plagiarism.
Mr. Evans, you gonna run from our cameras?
Court records show Evans seems to make a hobby out of suing people who cross him. Evans doesn't have the credentials and certifications he claims.
And so on and so forth, you get the idea. Well, Jericho of attrition.org joins me now, and mate, when did Evans first pop up on your radar?
He was actually first put on the errata section back in about 2002 after the release of his first book called High Tech Hustler. It was an extremely poorly written book about his so-called exploits, and it was given just a standard errata review, picked holes in it and put it up, and there wasn't a whole lot much more on him until about two and a half years ago. And that's when he kind of jumped back into the limelight and started, you know, spouting off about being the world's number one hacker, and he kind of jumped back on our radar.
So tell me about this first book. What was it actually about?
It's literally just kind of a first-person narrative of, hey, I was this badass hacker. I did this. I did that. I could hack anything. I could steal anything. And like I said, it was poorly written. It was just kind of stream of conscious. Didn't really, you know, sum up in a grand story.
So stream of consciousness, but not in a good James Joyce kind of way.
Not at all, no. Okay. More like someone who couldn't organize their thoughts, couldn't put together a good story, didn't really seem to have a start, a middle, and an end.
Okay, so lo and behold, after disappearing for a few years, he resurfaces and starts calling himself the world's greatest hacker. Now, there's nothing wrong with someone calling themselves, the world's number one or the world's greatest hacker, if no one's really going to be listening to them. But somehow this guy started getting booked for TV interviews all over the place.
Yes, that's because his company, Legat, actually is staffed primarily by PR and media-based employees. He only has a couple techies that we've been able to confirm, and at any given time, he literally has 10 to 15 people that their entire job is trying to get media attention, trying to book interviews. They actually solicit schools and say, hey, we would like our, you know, our CEO, Greg Evans, to come talk to your students about this.
Yeah, he does like talking to kids about staying safe online and stuff like that. But he's actually been, I mean, he hasn't just been on pissant networks. He's been on, you know, CNN, Fox,
Bloomberg, CNN.
Yeah. How? Yeah. How does no one trip to the idea? I mean, because, I mean, just for the listeners out there, how do we actually get across that this guy isn't actually what he claims? Because we seem to be taking that as assumed knowledge.
Two things about that question. Number one, he gets on these shows because he makes these wild claims and the news channels simply aren't performing due diligence. And it's the running theory among a lot of us now is that they really don't care. As long as he is colorful, gets a little controversy or whatever, it's good for the ratings. And there's no reason for them to, you know, stop him from showing up if he's helping their ratings.
But what sort of things does he say? I mean, you hint at controversy there, but I mean, is the commentary that he provides actually reasonable from the point of view of having someone to interview?
No, technically it's inaccurate. It's not helpful. As one example, he was on CNN and trying to talk about personal security, so he advertises his own service called Am I Hacker Proof? And the idea is you go to this website, you plug in your IP address, and it will scan you and tell you if you have any vulnerabilities. And he now brags that, you know, 300,000 people or whatever use this service. The problem is that service is fundamentally broken. You put in an IP address, and it doesn't actually scan you. It sends absolutely zero traffic to your IP address, and it'll just come back, you know, 30 seconds later saying you have no vulnerabilities. So now, if we're to believe him, that means over 300,000 people out there think that they're safe and they don't need to do anything to protect their computers, when in reality, they may be full of vulnerabilities or have certain issues on their computers that are easily exploited.
So I take it that you're basically calling, you've called this guy out as a charlatan, basically.
Yes.
Okay. And what was the reaction? I mean, obviously you thought that when you put together maybe a bit of an analysis, a bit of a critique that poked holes in what this guy was crapping on about on TV, you know, you thought if you made that public that that might actually cause him some distress, but it hasn't.
Well, it actually has.
Well, it has now, but it didn't for a long time, I guess is what I mean.
Actually, it did for a long time. We just didn't know. It's one of those things that where we publish our information, we don't exactly see how people are using it. And in this case, we got lucky in that his website was hacked and all of his email was leaked. And in some of the analysis of that email, we have now seen proof that people he went to trying to solicit for business or for, in one case, an apartment that he tried to rent under his mom's name, they actually did due diligence and they found our material and said, look, we see that you don't have the financial backing that you claim. We're going to deny you either the apartment or we're not going to do business with you. So that's kind of one of the things with Errata is that we put all this information out and we really just kind of hope that it's doing its job to some degree or another, even though we may not see it right away.
Mm-hmm. So where does this guy get his income from? That's one thing that I'm not quite clear on.
Right now, based on the analysis of not only his financials that he published in 2009 for his company, he did not publish any in 2010, which forced his company to become a limited pink sheet company. And then through the email leaks, he basically is just on a nonstop borrowing spree. We've got copies of voicemails that he saved in his email that show he borrowed as much as $50,000 from friends that are now trying to collect on it. His primary attorney that he used for many years, John Moore, actually filed bankruptcy recently, claiming $1.4 million in debt. And we have a string of emails, and we know that he has lent Evans a considerable amount of money, done a lot of work pro bono, and in the long term, it came back to bite him.
Well, look, speaking of attorneys, I understand that Gregory Evans is known to sue people who say negative things about him.
he's actually known to sue people for just about everything and anything he can. The amount of lawsuits that he is involved in, either where he is suing someone or being sued, is ridiculous. We have a list of over 20 cases that he's been involved in, and that's everything from claims against him for sexual harassment, where he sued detractors. His most well-known lawsuit was the so-called 25 John Doe case, where he tried to sue these people for, quote, stock bashing, because they said something negative about his company on message forums. It didn't cross into the category of libel or slander or defamation. It was all factual information, and he decided to try to sue anyway. And when the case was essentially dismissed, part of it was dismissed in reality, he came up with a press release saying, oh, well, this was part of our grand plan. You know, this was a distraction while everyone was focused on this. We were actually filing in federal court. And as of a couple of days ago, he still had not filed in federal court. There was no record of it. And based on how you file federal suits in the U.S., we're not sure he's even going to be able to do that at all.
So did you ever receive any contact from Greg Evans about all of this information, you know, regarding the information that you'd put online about him, calling him a charlatan and questioning his business?
No, he has never personally contacted us. And until about a month or two ago, he had actually left us out of everything. We were not included in the big John Doe case. We were not mentioned in press releases. We were not brought up at all. And I believe that he didn't want to point attention to us because the amount of information we had and how compelling it was. And roughly 2 months ago, he kind of changed his tune and he came up with another press release saying, well, because of all my haters, I'm more popular and I'm more wealthy now. And he named attrition.org finally in that.
Now, one thing that I'm curious about, though, and this is, I think, you know, high on the list of concerns for many who followed this, is that a guy like Greg Evans could be actually performing services for companies, security services for companies that are subpar and actually, you know, taking money for them. But it sounds like he's on that credit binge. So, you know, the collateral damage is somewhat limited. I mean, does the guy actually have clients?
It's very hard to tell. We know that he's had some clients here and there. And for any client that he has where he is actually performing security services, that is our biggest concern, and that is why we have the errata page up on him, because we know that his technical offerings are subpar and that anyone who pays him money is going to walk away likely feeling that they got a good deal, that they're secure, but in reality they aren't. And we base this on the fact that his own website has had just an unbelievable amount of vulnerabilities, and he has not been able to fix them in some time. And with the email leaks, we actually know that about 4 or 5 months ago, he received mail with a link to our site showing all those vulnerabilities. And even after he read that, he still could not or did not have anyone fix his own vulnerabilities. And if you kind of follow, you know, the logical progression, if he can or won't do that for his own site, and we obviously see that had disastrous side effects that, you know, he was compromised, two of his websites were deleted, his email was leaked. How does that translate to the companies that he's trying to protect?
So the death spiraling fireball that is Gregory D. Evans and Ligat Security seemed to intensify recently when CBS Atlanta, and he is based in Atlanta, I understand, CBS Atlanta actually did a four-minute expose on him. I imagine that would have felt quite satisfying for you.
It did. All in all, it wasn't really any new information. The best part was that it was mainstream media, and it was right there in his backyard in Atlanta, Georgia. So all the people that he focuses on trying to, you know, get them as clients and lies to them about whatever, they can start to see the reality of who he is. And CBS Atlanta, one of the things to note is they specifically said this, you know, he's appeared as an expert on CNN, Bloomberg, and even our own station. And CBS Atlanta finally did some research and said, wait a minute, this guy is a fraud, and they did the piece. Evans, in turn, has done another press release saying, you know, if I'm such a fraud, how is it I was on your show? Well, that's easy, Mr. Evans. You lied to them, and they just didn't perform due diligence at the time. They did now. They figured you out, and they did an expose.
So any ideas as to who popped his mail spool?
The best guess right now everyone has is based on the one-page kind of mini rant that was released with it that suggests that it was an inside job, that it was a disgruntled employee that either leaked or helped leak all of the mails. It's not difficult to believe at all because one of the things about Evan's company is the extremely high turnover rate. As best we can tell, and this is based on a combination of using LinkedIn, MySpace, his emails, and public postings, he seems to go through people at an unbelievable rate. And when I say go through, I mean they either quit in short order or he fires them. And oftentimes for what would be, you know, considered inexcusable reasons by most standards. He also is well known for one of his mails to the company where he establishes absolutely draconian policies about if you're 2 minutes late, you're fired. If you do this, you're fired. If you do that, you're fired. So the amount of disgruntled employees that have gone through Legat, it makes it very believable that that was how the email came out.
Yeah. No, it does sound like a plausible theory. This guy had actually been in prison previously, hadn't he, for other stuff like wire fraud or something?
Yes, 2 years in federal prison. He was convicted for wire fraud in California. Basically, he was, as best we can tell from the court records, he was calling up phone companies, ordering phone lines, using fraudulent means to pay for them, and then resell them to other companies for a profit. So if you listen to him tell it, he got busted for hacking when in reality, no, it was common fraud. It was social engineering at best.
And of course, one thing that made it into the that did make it into the CBS report also is that his second book, he wrote a second book called something like How to Become the World's Greatest Hacker or something, and he plagiarized entire chapters from other books. Is that right?
Actually, that wasn't his second book. That was closer to his seventh or eighth book. His book is called The World's Number One Hacker or How to Become the World's Number One Hacker. It was, I believe, his seventh or eighth book. And an independent analysis by Ben Rothkey found that almost 95% of the book was plagiarized.
Who published it? Was it self-published?
All of his books are self-published through what he calls Legat Publishing. And that's how he is able to publish these books.
Why is it that you think this bloke wound up in the information security industry?
Well, he probably honestly had a real passion at one time about hacking or computer security or phone security. And at an early age, you know, I have no doubt that that was his thing and he was into it like so many others. I just think at some point he wrapped his head around the idea of profit and money and maintaining this image. You know, one of his favorite things to say is that he's a computer security mogul and he's got this thing about living the life and driving expensive cars, living in expensive houses, going to these clubs. He does everything he can to maintain that image.
In the words of our former Prime Minister here in Australia, Paul Keating, he sounds like he's all tip and no iceberg.
Absolutely.
So where to from here for Gregory D. Evans? I mean, it sounds like that's pretty much it.
Well, he isn't giving up. He is, like I said, he issued a press release in response to the CBS Atlanta piece. He claims that he's already secured time on other media outlets to offer a rebuttal, and we look forward to him doing that, and we will continue to fight him.
Jericho from Attrition, thank you so much for joining us on Risky Business to discuss the wonderful tale of Gregory D. Evans and Legat Security.
Glad I could help.
Jericho of Attrition.org there on the line from the USA. Up next, it's time for this week's sponsor interview, and as I mentioned at the top of the show, we've got a new sponsor, NetWitness. They're pretty new in Australia, and they want all of you out there in listener land to know who they are and what they're on about so that you can stampede their booth at AusCert, which I'm sure you will. But these guys are actually doing some pretty interesting stuff. They will basically packet capture everything on your network and then analyze it, so they don't just grab logs, they grab everything, and that lets them do some pretty interesting analytics, detection, they can do session replay down the line, that sort of thing. So it's, you know, interesting products. But in this week's sponsor interview, NetWitness CSO Eddie Schwartz joins us to talk about fresh approaches to the malware issue. There's actually been a little bit of movement in the AV space lately. It seems the ineffectiveness of traditional solutions is finally driving some innovation. With all this unknown malware out there, and, you know, zero-day malware, I guess, if you want to call it that, some vendors have been trying to automate malware analysis and collection through traditional AV processes. So they'll take stuff, they'll sandbox it as it comes in, try to see if it does anything dodgy, and then create a SIG if it does. But to me, and indeed to Eddie, that sounds like, you know, what they called in The Simpsons the max power way. You know, there was the right way, the wrong way, and the max power way, which is just the wrong way, but faster. So Eddie doesn't really think that's a good approach, but he says if you can correlate enough information from up and down the, you know, the OSI 7 layers, you can actually start to spot stuff quite reliably, as he explained to me in this interview.
Let's say you're doing massive amounts of sandboxing on a reasonably fast connection point, you know, like a main gateway or something like that in a reasonable sized organization, you can't hold that sandbox instance open forever. So, you know, certain types of malware are going to do all kinds of different tricks to basically time out the sandbox and do different things that, you know, basically will bypass the capabilities of the sandbox to recognize inappropriate behavior or connections or actions. So relying on sandboxing alone for zero-day identification is a flawed process in and of itself. So really, the game of zero-day malware detection has to include multiple vectors of analysis. And again, you know, let's take another example. Imagine that you work in a government agency somewhere in Australia, just for the sake of argument. Let's suppose that some user's machine is suddenly doing an outbound connection over port 443, just for the sake of argument. That connection over port 443 is not using SSL, is connecting to a website that is located somewhere in China and is downloading a zip file. Now, if this were a bank or something like that, and it was using a special banking protocol and all of this, maybe that behavior would be okay. But suppose it's some law enforcement or intelligence agency or some, you know, defense-oriented organization. That combination of factors, the layer 3 and 4 vector, the couple of layer 7 vectors that I mentioned, the fact that it's a zip file, maybe we even know that the zip file contains exe files because of recursive analysis, the fact that the TLD is located in China. When you add those together, that equals basically a security policy violation. Committed by the end user or not, their machine did this, beknownst to them or not, right? So that factor is something that would also cause that file to immediately be included as a suspect file, as much as misbehaving in a sandbox would cause that file to be suspect.
I hear what you're saying, right, which is that, you know, if you keep an eye out for enough suspicious behavior, you know, up and down the 7 layers, right, and you can start to correlate certain suspicious things that are happening, you can sort of tie it all together and get a pretty accurate idea of when something's doing you harm. I guess the problem as I see it is that, you know, this is all relying on stupid things that the bad guys are doing, like using, you know, non-protocol compliant data exfiltration. You know, what do you do when these guys stop writing bad exfiltration software? What do you do when they start writing software that just blends in perfectly? Because it seems to me that theoretically, it's quite possible to create a piece of malware, and I'm sure there is malware like this out there being used by, you know, maybe intelligence organizations and maybe even criminal organizations, that's basically impossible to detect. You know, so what are we going to do to address those sorts of issues?
You know, you're always going to have something that's going to get through. You're always going to have something that's going to be undetected. I would be lying if I said that, you know, there's some perfect solution, right? But the idea is to continue to combine as many vectors as you can to reduce that, you know, what I like to call attacker free time, or that gap. Mm-hmm. As much as possible. So, yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, there's, you know, the whole issue of blending in. But, you know, typically, as these things go, there are signs, there are mistakes committed. You know, people say, oh, there's no perfect crime, right? You know, I don't know if that's true or not. There probably have been perfect crimes. But there are just so many possible questions that you can ask that have both been sort of figured out historically by people, have been asked by, you know, the security community over time. And, you know, I guess the bottom line is this, you know, historically as a community, we've relied on flawed information like log files, NetFlow, and other things. But, you know, let's imagine instead of, you know, having that kind of reliance, that we just agree that we're going to record everything that crosses the wire, and we're going to optimally index that, you know, with the security mind, you know, with the mind of a security person, you know, so it's optimally prepared. Now we're only limited by our imagination and the ability to ask questions. Now, I know that sounds kind of pie in the sky, but it really does boil down to the fact that there are things that we know, there are things that we don't understand. Today, we have the knowledge of the thousands of questions we understand about the way malware writers do things, about the way they have been doing things. And there are trends and mistakes that they make and they're going to make that we benefit from that are not signatures.
Yeah, I hear where you're going. I mean, it sounds like you're actually being very Rumsfeldian about this, and you're talking about the unknown unknowns that might pop up in the future. And look, I agree that it seems like a really sensible approach. It was an approach that first occurred to me probably when I was speaking to the SourceFire guys about their near real-time, you know, detection sort of right. stuff. The idea that we don't have to do everything in real time, that we can perhaps keep some sort of log like that, like a bit of a packet log of what's going in, what's going out, index it right, and then run analytics on it later on to see, hey, maybe we did get popped by this worm 6 months ago.
So, and you know, we're not actually doing anything post-fact. Well, we are doing it post-facto if you want to, but see, this technology has evolved to where this is a real-time activity. So in other words, people would never accept the notion that, oh, gee, maybe I should record and capture everything and operate in a real-time basis on this. You know, if you want to use Rumsfeldian words, since you insulted me in that way, what I'm gonna say to you is situational awareness. I mean, this notion that you can actually have these volumes of data and be able to have these analytic processes running on them for different purposes, whether it's data exfiltration, whether it's automated malware analysis, and so on. Sure, you know, 5 years ago, was it really feasible to do this? No. But is it feasible to do this today? Absolutely. And most people believe, at least in, you know, government agencies, leading organizations, that the only way to get at the ultimate truth of what's going on their network is to have all the data available. And it really boils down to, you know, how much disk space can you put on? Can you put towards this problem?
So, I mean, do you foresee, though, a time when you will be able to do retrospective analytics on sort of captured data and say, you know, we got owned by XYZ, you know, 6 months ago? Do you reckon that's something that might happen?
Yeah, well, that happens right now. I mean, you know, in the business I'm in, I mean, we have customers that do in fact do that for 6 months of data, where, you know, the CISO calls up and said, hey, this new Microsoft vulnerability that came out on Tuesday, how vulnerable have we been to it? You know, because we don't have a signature for it. We don't have an IPS, signature for it.
We don't have an IPS rule for an attacker to bypass.
Right. And, you know, but you know, it's very easy for an organization that's captured all the data. And if you're dealing with an open platform, to be able to look back and say, all right, well, you know, we have everything here. How do we look at this? You know, and there's so many applications of this once you get into it. We like to say around here, it's sort of like the Apple model of there's an app for that.
So you're over there at RSA. I imagine that it's all cloud all the time, and everyone's talking about the cloud and the cloud and the cloud with a bit more cloud, 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 cloud. But in addition to that, I mean, are you seeing much innovation on the trade floor? Because it seems like for a long time we hit this sort of innovative flat spot, and it seems like things might be picking up again.
Yeah, so it's funny. I was talking to a friend of mine I've known forever. We worked together a couple companies, and he's the head of security at one of the largest banks in the U.S. now. And he was walking around saying, oh my gosh, there's nothing new going on here. And I don't think that's entirely true. I mean, I think that, you know, there are a couple of innovative technologies in the cloud space. I think there are, you know, some innovative technologies in the, you know, malware and advanced threats area. You know, there are a couple of people that have some good ideas on identity management. But, you know, these shows, you know how it works. I mean, the biggest booths get the most attention. And then there's these little tiny guys in the corner. And the poor guys are screaming as loud as they can to get, you know, waving their hands around.
All right. Well, Eddie Schwartz, thank you so much for joining us on the line from California, from the RSA conference. We appreciate your time, mate. And we'll speak to you again soon, I'm sure.
That sounds great.
I drank a bottle down, called to hear the news. You told me not to worry, but I know that's not the truth.
Eddie Schwartz on the line there with this week's sponsor interview, and big thanks to NetWitness for supporting Risky Business. And that's it for this week's show. This track is from Marshall and the Fro, Buy It Now. Tune in next week for an interview with Wired.com's Kevin Poulsen. We'll be chatting to him about his new book, Kingpin, which is due out on February 22. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
I've been squished and squashed and going back and forth. I've been squished and squashed. I kicked an hourglass that didn't speak a sound. You told me that I love you for the rest of my life. The house in the sand, my feet on the edge, running to you just as fast as I can. I've been squished and squashed and going back and forth. I've been squished and squashed again. I've been squished and squashed. Squashed again. I've been squished and squashed.